You're very welcome to this, a special event marking the recent centenary of composer James Wilson's birth. I'm Jonathan Grimes, Head of Content at the Contemporary Music Centre, and we're at the Irish Institute of Music and Song in Balbriggan, County Dublin, as part of this year's Irish Composition Summer School. Jim Wilson was born in London in 1922, and after a career in the British Navy during the war, he settled in Ireland in 1949, living in Dublin for the remainder of his life. He was Professor of Composition at the Royal Irish Academy of Music and a founder member of Éisteanna, Ireland's state-sponsored Academy of Creative Artists. A prolific composer, his output includes 8 operas, numerous orchestral works, as well as countless chamber, solo instrumental and vocal pieces. Jim was a tutor on the Irish Composition Summer School for many years, so when we discovered that this year was the Summer School's 40th anniversary, we were delighted that John McLaughlin, the course administrator, agreed for us to host this event. Jim Wilson's contribution to music in Ireland is considerable, not least through his musical output, but also as a teacher of many composers and as an advocate for music in Ireland. For these reasons, it's fitting that we in CMC, along with our friends and colleagues here today, look back on his legacy and discuss this through the lens of 2023. We'll hear from our guests shortly, who I'll introduce in a minute, but we begin with music not by Jim Wilson, firstly, but by 2 of the composers who'll be joining me to discuss Jim's music and the Irish Composition Summer School, Martin O'Leary and John Buckley. Performed by Martin, we'll hear 2 pieces written to celebrate Jim Wilson's 70th birthday, John Buckley's Jim Singing and Martin's Jim's Air from Gymnopédie, a collection of 10 pieces. So please give a warm welcome to Martin O'Leary.
Thank you.
Thanks, Martin. That was John Buckley's Jim singing and Martin O'Leary's Jim's Air, performed by Martin himself. I'd like to introduce our distinguished panel. We have composers Jane O'Leary, right next to me, John Buckley, Rona Clark, and Martin, whom you've met already. And Martin, if I could begin with you, the two pieces you just played were actually performed, I believe, during the summer school in 1992 for Jim's 70th birthday. Tell me how they came about.
Yeah, it's something that I will never ever do again, which is give 9 premieres in one concert. There were 10 pieces. The 10th one, by the way, was Michael Alcorn's, who was also a director at summer school. He played his own piece, maybe because he didn't trust me to play it, I'm not sure, but let's not go into that. The pieces were meant as a surprise for Jim on his 70th birthday, so we had to inveigle Jim to go to one of Michael's lectures, which was on the Donlan in the main auditorium. And he wasn't sure. We said we wanted him to play a piano example, and he said, yeah, but why don't you do it, Martin? And I said, and I came up with some excuse. I can't think what it was. Anyway, we got him there, and Michael was doing something on semiotic analysis. And I think Jim and myself were both going, yeah, I have no idea what that is. But he eventually produced this thing where he sort of drew back something, and we looked and we saw letters and numbers that spelt out Happy Birthday, Jim. And then the look on Jim's face when he saw that was worth the price of admission. Even though it was free, it was worth the price of admission. So he sat there dutifully as we played these pieces for him, which was a lovely idea, I think. The final one, which unfortunately we won't be performing this evening, involved John Buckley and Michael Alcorn dancing with Pink Umbrellas by the German composer Peter Michael Hamel. There was John Caskin as well, and otherwise it was people like Marion Inglesby. Rona wrote a piece as well. Gráinne Mulvey wrote a piece, Maura Eaton wrote a piece. I'm going to probably forget somebody out of the 10 now, so this is terrible. Paul, of course, wrote a wonderful piece called Jamboree Dawn, which I've played on a number of occasions since, which is actually a sort of a reflection, if I can just come to Paul's piece briefly, because I think this is sort of a filling in a picture of Jim as well as a teacher. Paul, as those of you who know Paul, and if you don't, now you know, is quite shy and soft-spoken, and went to Jim, no doubt, with his music and showed it to him. And I'm sorry, I'm going to have to do an impersonation of Jim. It's very, very hard to not talk about Jim without impersonating him. And I've done it to his face, so it's okay. It's not disrespectful at all. But Paul's piece was apparently very delicate and lots of tinkering around. And Jim basically said to him, why don't you splash around a bit? And started bashing the piano. And that's actually in Paul's piece. So there was a personal input. Mine took the musical letters of Jim's name, of which there aren't many, by the way. It was just an A and an E and an E flat. That was it. So that didn't offer me an awful lot. And John's piece quotes from a piece of Jim's called Emily Singing. So therefore calling it Jim Singing made perfect sense. So it was a lovely, one-off occasion. And I think Jim was genuinely delighted.
John, as founder of the Irish Composition Summer School, in 1983, you invited Jim to join you as tutor in the, I believe it's the second year of the summer school. And before that, he was your first composition teacher. What was he like as a teacher, and how did his teaching shape your musical development?
Very interesting question, John, and thank you. Yes, Jim Wilson was my composition teacher from 1972 to about 1975 or 76. Now, I say about because in those days there were no degrees as such, or masters or PhDs. So while I did study with him in the Royal Irish Academy of Music, the lessons were kind of on a private basis. Actually, at one point, we gave up the Royal Irish Academy of Music and I would regularly go to his house for lessons. His teaching method was quite extraordinary. He always sought to find out what the student was looking to express. So there were no rigorous or rigid approaches. He would look at what you'd written. You brought in your sketches every week. He would analyze them. And mainly his advice was more technical. It had to do with things like notation, with to do with instrumentation, on which he was something of an expert. He knew what every instrument was capable of doing. And so he would advise on technical aspects like that, rather than suggesting aesthetic approaches to music. So to follow on with your question, when I began the summer school in 1983, it became apparent after 1 year that I wasn't going to be able to sustain this and develop it, that I needed not an assistant, but a co-director. And of course, I immediately thought of James Wilson, having been my own teacher, and he added an immense richness, needless to say, to the summer school, bringing his wonderful range of experience. And his teaching methods exactly coincided with my own, as I would always seek to find out what the student was trying to express and to find the best way of doing that, rather than imposing any strategy or, heaven forbid, any personal approaches on the work of the student.
This brings me to a quote on teaching from Jim that... comes from an interview that I did with Jim in 2005, which incidentally was one of the last interviews he gave, because I was looking at the date the other day. It was the 11th of July 2005. It's up on the CMC website. And he passed away, I think, on the 6th of August 2005, so a mere 3 weeks or so later. But on teaching, I just thought it's funny to quote this here. I've loved teaching. It's a curious business. I can't do the gym accent, by the way, so you can just imagine this. Looking back over the years, some of the people who, at the time, I said to myself, "Now this moron, I'm totally wasting my time on this one. He will never be any good. It's time I sent him home." I didn't do so, and they blossomed into quite good composers since, but gave me no indication whatever when I was teaching them that they'd ever do anything.
I presume he mentioned me in that sentence, Jonathan.
I think I followed up the question by saying, well, I'm not going to ask you to name any names, but... Rona, you first came across Jim through performing one of his works as a teenager. Tell me about this.
I was about 15 or 16, and I was singing with the Lindsay Singers, and also at that stage with the Leong Lindsay Singers, and... we gave with the, this will age me now, the RTE Light Orchestra and conductor Eamor O'Brien, the premiere performance of five of his A Christmas Canticle. So I remember Jim coming to a rehearsal. He didn't speak, he did not address us directly. You know, he would have spoken to Ethna Barrer, the director, and made any changes there. So, all those years later, then when I attended the Ennis Summer School, there was Jim as one of the teachers, one of the directors. Mm.
Do you remember about his approach in the piece to writing for young singers? I mean, was it an enjoyable piece to perform?
What really delighted me was singing with the orchestra. I didn't find the vocal lines in themselves especially interesting to sing, because they were very simple. Mm. The style was quite syllabic, really, and natural speech inflections, but with no great complexity in the rhythm. So, and the lines were quite restricted, you know. I'd say he was restricting himself in this, in writing for young singers. But when it came together with the orchestra, that was a huge thrill. It really was.
Mm-hmm. Jane, you got to know Jim very well through your ensemble Concord, which during much of the 80s, 90s and 2000s performed many solo and chamber pieces by Irish composers, premiered, commissioned, etc., including quite a few of Jim's works. What was he like to work with?
Well, I'll just say that we had a very close relationship with Jim. Probably he was the most performed composer on our repertoire list. And between 1978 and 2016, we performed more than 20 different pieces in 34 concerts. I was quite shocked when I went through the programs and added them up. And it's obvious that we enjoyed working with him, and we enjoyed his music. And he was so prolific. He always had a piece waiting to be performed, and he had loads of pieces that hadn't been performed, and he'd just keep handing them to us, you know, and we'd try and fit him in as best we could. But Jim was very different from other composers that we played. I think in many ways he was a very special and unique person. You couldn't compare him to anyone. And we talk about his music later, maybe. But as a composer that we performers were dealing with, I thought it very unusual that he never wanted to be involved in a rehearsal. He was very adamant that I've written the piece, here you go, do what you like with it. I suppose it was kind of a trust. But it was unusual, and I still find that unusual that he didn't want to attend the rehearsal, you know.
And would he have spoken to you about the piece while he was writing it?
No, not really. No, it was there on the page, and it was up to us to figure it out. But his notation was quite unusual. He left it very open. I mean, he was way back in the 70s writing music without bar lines, with little gestural things and very free on the page. And immediately I admired that freedom that he allowed. You know, it was unusual at that time.
Yeah. And Martin, one of the things about Jim, as well as the vocal music and the operas that he wrote, was his interest in writing for solo instruments. He wrote countless solo pieces. I just checked today in our catalogue in the CMC, and there are over 30 solo works in CMC's library for a range of instruments. It seemed important to him to fully understand the capabilities of what he was writing for. And this comes through in many of the works, including the three playthings for a solo clarinet, which we're going to hear shortly. Maybe talk to me a little bit about this approach to writing for solo instruments from your perspective.
In such an extensive catalogue, partly, it may have been his intention to go, well, I've done that, so I'll try a different instrument as much as anything else. There's a large number of concertos as well. I think the idea was, and this informed his teaching on the composition summer school as well, which we can talk about. Well, we could talk about it at great length, but his knowledge of his orchestration lectures in particular, I think, were the ones that we always felt, well, this is where he's in his home domain, because he knew exactly what he was talking about, both in terms of orchestral texture, but also the individual characteristics, as you've said, of the instruments. So, you know, whether it was the sort of the upper register of the clarinet in its particular timbre, or the fact that the trombones would cut through this, that, or the other, or, you know, and he would throw these quotes in, like the Richard Strauss one about don't look at the brass, it only encourages them, this sort of thing. To take that, but also playing extracts which would show that he had that precise imagination, which made him, I think, such a good orchestral composer in particular, because he had the ear of an orchestral composer. So I think in some respects, I don't know, we didn't really talk about this, but I would think that a lot of the solo pieces were sort of to take that character and then test himself with just one line, let's say, in a piece, what he could extract from that and how interesting he could make it, which to my mind, he always made interesting.
And so to our next piece, which is a neat segue into it. His three playthings for clarinet. This work was written in 1983 for the British clarinetist Alan Hacker, and I'm delighted that we're joined today by Patrick Burke, who's going to perform this piece for us. Please welcome Patrick to play James Wilson's Three Playthings for Clarinet. James Wilson's Three Playthings, performed by Patrick Burke. Thanks very much, Paddy. Jane, there's a great energy in this piece and a playfulness, and also what you mentioned earlier about that kind of freedom. Hearing this piece, do you recognise his personality as you remember him?
Yes, indeed. I think it's a very typical piece, and you asked about his solo pieces, and sometimes a solo piece is just a line and there's not a lot of variety in it. But Jim's music is always full of fantasy and gestures that seem alive, and that's what, you know, I'm amazed how he can create this texture, use the whole range, the different sounds of the instrument, and carry us along on this little journey he often spoke about music being the closest thing to magic that he knew. And I think that actually epitomizes his music, you know, that it's a bit fantastical. It's very full of imagination. Mm. And it's beautifully written for the instrument.
Anybody else want to come in on that? Rona?
I absolutely agree with what Jane has said. And I think it's indicative of how Jim the man and Jim the composer, the personality and the music are one and the same. He was a person who, on the one hand, was extremely serious, didn't suffer fools gladly. On the other hand, there was always a sense of childlike playfulness in his nature. And somebody who never became old, he always had that energy, you know, right to the end. He had that sparkle in his personality, and it shows in much of his music.
Looking back on his life in Ireland, he arrived in 1949, and it was 15 years before one of his works was performed in Dublin. And reading Mark Fitzgerald's book on his life and music, which I have here, this was published a few years ago, there's a steely determination to keep going and to succeed as a composer. And it must be said, John, that his route to becoming a composer, it wasn't conventional or straightforward compared to today. Maybe for those who mightn't be familiar with his backstory, you might provide a little bit of insight into that.
Well, exactly. When he came to Ireland in 1949, he had a difficult time in getting his music accepted initially. There are numerous letters back and forth to various conductors saying, oh, this can't be played and so forth. And it took him quite a while, actually, before he became accepted, I think, and established as a composer here. His career in Britain, he had written music in the 40s, of course, but it wasn't really performed. His career in Britain is more tied into his work as a civil servant in Whitehall and subsequently his work as a naval officer. So when he came to Dublin, he had to start establishing himself from the beginning. Mm. And I think the first work of significance that he wrote might be The Hunting of the Snark, which was a type of chamber opera based on Lewis Carroll. Great piece of fun, by the way. I think that was 1965, as far as I can remember. And that started his route into Irish society as a composer. But it can take quite a while to establish yourself even nowadays as a composer, though things are much more opportunities for younger composers. I see some here, maybe you're studying on the summer school. There are more opportunities available now. In those days, it wasn't that easy to find your way, particularly in Ireland. Mm. I think he would have had way more opportunities had he remained in Britain and wished to pursue his career there. But he came to Ireland for personal reasons.
Staying with the composition teaching part of this discussion and turning once again to the Irish Composition Summer School, which, as I mentioned earlier, is celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. And I'd like at this point to bring in the course administrator, John McLaughlin. John, do you want to join us there in the piano stool? It's a very different world now in 2023 compared to 1983, as John was just talking about when John Buckley established the summer school. Why is the summer school still important and relevant to young and emerging composers today, would you say?
Yes, as John alluded, there's obviously now postgrads and doctorates in composition, and there really wasn't, so this has changed. But it's a variable picture from place to place, but it's quite common for third-level institutions to give very few actual opportunities to workshop and to hear the music, and to hear the music by the instruments that they're writing for. It's a patchy picture, and some institutions, you might, of course, during COVID, you might have passed through a degree, a 4-year degree, and not actually had your work performed, or even though you were having it assessed and graded. In other places, there's some effort to bring people in, but one notes with anecdotal detail that very rarely are the performers paid in any way the right sort of rates when these things happen. But at any rate, the intense week, or more than a week, that we offer, 9 or 10 days, depending from year to year, it's a great opportunity to really just focus and to not be distracted by other things. Because, of course, if you're doing, well, certainly an undergrad degree, you have history essays and all sorts of things getting in the way, and you're constantly dancing around, you might be performing and all the rest. So to be able to really focus and then have a piece that might be portfolio material, but certainly you get a quality recording, so you have a sort of archival thing, and it's, you know, it's a stage where you say, right, well, there's that piece anyway, and people come back the next year so they can go to the next stage. So like we've had a lot of people who've done it 3 times, that's not uncommon, and others who've done it twice and so forth. So I've had to make this argument, of course, to the Arts Council on numerous occasions, to say, well, you know, why are we a good thing to keep supporting? And my usual argument is quite simply, what we offer is really not offered anywhere else. The other thing that is offered from time to time freely in other places, like the Association of Irish Composers used to do, would, you know, organise a workshop. But that tended to be a 2-day thing. So it was like, arrive with peace. no teaching element. So that differs. So yeah, I can usually argue that we're unique in the Irish landscape. And indeed, there's not too many anywhere else. I've noted, you know, obviously Darmstadt and Donna Eschingen are famous ones and so forth, and there's probably a number in the United States I haven't heard of or whatever, and Voix Nouvelle in France. But it's remarkable how few the courses that last such a length of time with this kind of engagement and tutorializing, so that you improve the piece and so forth as you go through, and then get a nice, hopefully, high-quality digital recording at the end. Very thin on the ground. So we do attract people. We've attracted people from Israel, Serbia. We had Albania there recently, and of course quite a few from the States and the United Kingdom normally, not to mention all the places in Ireland that you can think of. So yeah. So I mean, just by that alone, it's quite clear that we provide a service that is needed.
Mm. And am I right in saying, John, when you set this up, you were modelling it on a summer school that was ran by John Cage and Merce Cunningham?
Correct, Jonathan. You have a very, very good recollection.
I've done my research.
You've done your research very well. In 1981, I took part as a student on an international course for composers and choreographers at the University of Surrey, Guildford. And the directors were the incredible American choreographer Merce Cunningham, and the musical director was none other than John Cage. And it was an extraordinary ferment. It was an international course, so there were composers and choreographers literally from all over the world. So I found it very intriguing, of course, to be engaged in such an international congress, I suppose, for the first time that I had experienced it so close. So when an opportunity arose to organise something in Clare, that was at the back of my head. I spent 1982 in Clare trying to come up with some ideas for the local arts organisation, and I came up with about 4 different possible projects, one of which was the summer school. And the first year, 1983, I delivered it on my own with, I think, 8 students, all from Ennis, County Clare, all doing music for their Leaving Cert. And we had to play the music ourselves, of course, that they wrote, and they did little exercises and so forth. And it was on that I had the imagination to try and build a school the following year, inviting James Wilson to participate as composer. The year after, we got professional musicians to perform. Then we started inviting international guests to deliver talks and so on. And of course, before long, we were attracting international students as well. So though it was taking place in a small parish, our vision wasn't parochial, I would say. Our vision was much, much broader. I find it extraordinary that 40 years later, the course is still going ahead and attracting young students, whom I'm looking forward to speaking to later. So it's been a It's been a long process, but it built up really from my own experience of having attended that summer school with Merce Cunningham and John Cage.
Amazing. Rona, you mentioned that you were a student on this summer school back in the day. What do you remember of this experience?
Oh, I remember it vividly. I think it was 1984. John, I think it was 84, my first year.
The second year.
And I mean, it was just a revelation for me because I had gone through the whole basic degree process of BMUS, but we didn't hear music very much beyond 1900. I remember Saoirse Bodley did introduce a Webern quartet and also Boulez Le Marteau Sans Maître, neither of which I particularly liked, so that didn't really excite me. But at the summer school, I mean, John introduced me to Crumb, Berio. I'll never forget hearing Black Angels for the first time. That really was quite a revelation. The music of Lutoslawski. So, and he had this was, of course, well before the days of the internet when you could get Encoder and YouTube and find everything on Spotify and so on. Well before that. So, you know, John had there would be a score there of Crumb, these huge scores, for example, and being able to see these scores and hear recordings, you know, and John, you know, speaking about these particular works. Jim tended to speak, interestingly enough, at least in those couple of years, spoke about historical works and his own works. I remember him speaking about The Hunting of the Snark and the 7-8 rhythms and how they were, you know, they were not difficult. That somebody had implied that these were too difficult for children, but, you know, his stating that they were natural, using natural speech rhythms, and, you know, once the children would know this, they had no problem picking up those rhythms. So it was, you know, it was hugely important in my career as a composer. Looking through the list of works on the Contemporary Music Centre's site yesterday, I was really taken with the number of works that have not been by Jim that have not been performed at all, and very performable works. I'm not talking about operas. You know, you might say, well, you know, the resources aren't there for you know, constant opera performances. But something like a mass, for heaven's sake, he has a Missa Brevis that has never been performed, or, you know, some sonatas and smaller pieces. But then on the other hand, something like that viola concerto, Menora, is such a very great work. It is it is so beautifully written for viola and orchestra. John mentioned earlier the economy, the economic use of the orchestra. The style of orchestration is so superb in that work. I am surprised that it is not taken up also by great viola players all over the world.
We have a final work by Jim, which will be performed by Martin, his five preludes. Martin, what can you tell us about this piece you're about to play? And perhaps there may be another Jim impression in the explanation.
Well, even before I come to that, just like to say that I don't know any composer who will tell you that they're overperformed, living, obviously. Well, they can't tell you if they're dead. But what somebody needs is a champion who is a performer. You need a conductor, let's say, to go, okay, I'm going to record Jim's orchestra. I know this myself because a composer I'm very fond of is Harvey Goulbrien. He's got Martin Brabbins now, who has conducted operas, symphonies. All his symphonies are available on CD. It was a struggle for him to get there. I mean, he never heard an awful lot of his work. So I think that's the short, simple answer to it, is he needs a champion, basically. He's not there to champion it himself anymore. Now, to the preludes. They are written for John O'Connor, it says on the score. I know Tony Byrne has played them, I think. I'm the only other person who's played them. I stand to be corrected, but I think that's true. They're written in 1982. There's five of them. What he does is he puts the title at the end, which, if you know anything about preludes, is something that a certain Claude Debussy does. And I'm sure that's not a coincidence. I'm sure it's part of his identification with and admiration for Debussy's music. The music doesn't sound like Debussy, but I think it's a very nice idea that almost implies that the title is an afterthought. I'm not quite sure it is in Jim's case, but anyway. So the five pieces, let me hope I can remember the titles of them now. First one is called Flux. Second one is Night Cloud. Third one is Dazzle. The fourth one, this is where the impression is necessary, is called It Was Working All Right Yesterday. And the final one is called Homeward. And I think they make a wonderful set where something that we haven't mentioned about Jim is his wonderful sense of humour. And by God, you can hear that, I think, in certainly in the fourth piece out of the five. I will be very disappointed if I don't hear some giggles while I'm playing. And humour is one of the most difficult things to bring off in music without sounding like a complete idiot in trying to be funny. Banana skins are not funny in music. Musical humour is a very peculiar thing, but Jim understood it. And this is oddly enough, I don't think he would have seen this, and he may not even have thought of it at the time, but you think of Ligeti's music where mechanisms break down, and Ligeti's particularly interested in that. Well, sort of Jim got there before him with this piece, because it's about the same thing, something that was working all right the previous day, but quite obviously, and it won't be hopefully mistakes of mine that mean it's not working. But you get the point, I think, in the music. So it's that understanding of musical language as well, that in a word, he can encompass what the piece is about that I find so compelling about these pieces. And I'd just like to dedicate this to him, this performance, because he's still very close to me.
Well, we'll let you make your way to the side, to the piano to play this. And while Martin is getting ready, I'd like to thank our panel, Jane O'Leary, John Buckley, Rona Clark, and Martin O'Leary. Thanks also to Patrick Burke for his performance earlier, to John McLaughlin for his contribution also of the Irish Composition Summer School, and my colleague Stephanie Ford for coordinating this event. Also, thanks to Breda McCarthy and everyone at the Irish Institute of Music and Song for hosting us, and to Paul Lynch on sound. And so, to perform James Wilson's Five Preludes for Piano, Opus 87, please welcome Martin O'Leary again. Thank you.
Thank you.